KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland, California.
San Leandro.
I live in West Berkeley.
El Cerrito.
I live in Pinole,
Albany.
Coming up, San Francisco approves a plan to build its largest homeless navigation center on the Embarcadero waterfront against neighborhood opposition. Then we'll hear about San Francisco's Theater of Yugen and how it continues to bring new and old traditions to Japanese performance.
How can we use some of these Japanese aesthetics to better reveal the intricacies of Western literature?
And we'll hear one of San Francisco's signature sounds with a little amplification.
I'm going to clap three times. You'll hear the echo that's been created by the sound system.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. San Francisco approved a plan to build its largest homeless navigation center yet, against vehement opposition from some residents. The center will be built on what is currently a parking lot on the Embarcadero, near the Exploratorium. KALW's housing and economy reporter Liza Veal is here. Liza, some residents are not happy about this plan.
This is by far the most organized opposition to a navigation center that I've seen. As soon as the plan was proposed, a bunch of residents started a petition, and they've raised over $100,000 to hire a lawyer to fight the plan. And then at the Port Commission hearing on Tuesday, they showed up with signs saying, keep Embarcadero safe, not good for residents, not good for visitors. You can hear them chanting, we live here.
All right, so a lot of opposition, but this plan passed anyway.
Yeah, it passed unanimously. During public comment, which went on for 4 hours, there were actually twice as many people speaking in favor of the center as against it. So the housing activist community churned out. You know, this has been such a big fight. The Coalition on Homelessness and the YIMBY Action Group organized all their members to come and show their support.
Right, but a lot of the neighbors said that they didn't want it. So what are they concerned about? What the people who oppose it?
Yeah, they are worried that the navigation center will attract unsafe or unsavory behavior. Mm. They're worried about crime, personal safety. And the city has studied the impacts of navigation centers on neighborhoods and reports that there's no link between their existence and crime. But it's hard to argue the centers don't change their immediate surroundings. One woman, Judy Dundas, came with photos she'd taken outside of other navigation centers around the city, and she talked about what those sites look like right now.
If none of you have actually walked by a navigation center, you absolutely need to delay the vote. A chop shop, a bicycle chop shop, right in front of 5th and Bryan. Encampment, right in front of Division Circle. Biohazardous waste.
One man said he'd calculated that the center would attract over 1,000 additional active drug users. But on the other hand, here is how one resident, Sarah Carmet, characterized her experience of living next to a homeless shelter.
I would be lying if I said that it wasn't hard and heartbreaking to see what I see every day. It is hard and it is heartbreaking. What it is not is unsafe. As is being suggested here on these orange signs, it is not in and of itself unsafe to live near a shelter. It has not made me less safe, it has made me more compassionate. What is unsafe, however, is sleeping outdoors. People die when they sleep outdoors, and that's the real issue here today. So I would ask everyone holding up an orange sign what they mean by safe. Whose safety are you talking about? All of us are safer when everyone in San Francisco can sleep indoors.
Okay, so Liza, how does the city respond to these concerns of opposition? It's been really vocal.
Well, the plan has actually been modified in response to these protests. The main thing is they've promised to add dedicated beat patrol officers to the site to maintain safety. They also scaled down the number of beds a little. It's now starting with 130 instead of over 200, though they will phase in more over time. And then instead of a 4-year lease, they have just a 2-year lease right now with the option to extend the timing after evaluating the success.
All right, well, let's step back for a second and talk about navigation centers. They've been really popular with San Francisco City Government. How have these been working differently from regular shelters?
Well, they're better because they're more flexible. People can come and go. They can bring their possessions, their dogs. They can sleep with their partners. They can eat whenever they want. And then there are these 30-day time limits. The idea was everyone that comes through gets navigated to permanent housing, but that's certainly not the reality. About 1 in 6 leave to permanent housing.
So that leaves quite a few people. What's happening to everybody else?
A big chunk of people, about 1 in 3, leave the city altogether when they leave the shelter. Mm. They take a free bus ticket to a relative or a friend who's agreed to put them up.
That's been policy for a long time.
Yeah, that's the Homeward Bound program. It's a controversial program because there's evidence that a lot of those people stay homeless just, you know, in another city, or else they come back to San Francisco and go through the whole process again. So there's those people. And then there's another third of clients who leave navigation centers and are still homeless. But Jeff Kaczynski, the head of the Homeless and Supportive Housing Department, he pushed back on this idea that navigation centers are failing at their job just because not every single person that goes through them gets housed.
I want to say that I would dispute that that does not mean they do not work. Yes, these are temporary shelters. Not everybody who's coming in is going to find a pathway out of homelessness the first time. But nonetheless, I believe that one night off of the street where someone could get a safe place to be, a meal, somebody to talk to and to be part of a community, rather than sleeping outside by themselves, alone and on the streets, is in fact a success.
All right. So, Liza, the Embarcadero Navigation Center is going to provide 130 more beds for people who are currently sleeping on the streets.
Yep. Yeah. It's a small dent in the 4,500 or so people that sleep outside every night in the city, but it's something.
Yeah. And since navigation centers are basically the city's strategy for addressing homelessness at this point, then we're going to see more battles like this in other parts of the city.
Yes. Mayor Breed, her plan is to add 1,000 shelter beds throughout the whole city by the year 2020. So it's a safe bet that we'll go through this again pretty soon.
Yeah, it's an ambitious plan. Well, thank you very much for covering this, Liza.
Thank you.
Liza Veal is KALW's housing and economics reporter. You can reach her at economy@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. More than 40 years ago, San Francisco's Theater of Yugen became one of the first American theater companies to feature classical Japanese theater arts. The company started as a place for experimentation, and it continues to blend ancient forms of Japanese theater with modern Eastern and Western traditions. Theater of Yugen's latest production is an adaptation of the classic Greek tragedy Helen, and the company's artistic director, Nick Ishimaru, sat down with KALW's Truk Nguyen to talk about the theater's history.
Our theater company, we are the only company in the world that performs Kyogen in English. And so our company's work was originally founded in translating those stories and then tweaking the translations ever so slightly to make them more relatable for an American audience. Mm-hmm. No tradition is founded largely in Buddhism. And so that idea of the transcendental world, of the ephemeral, of things coming in and then slowly fading away, mm-hmm. and recognizing that that's going to happen, but learning to be okay with it, that process of slow recognition and reconciliation, there is Yugen in that. There is a beauty in it. So I like to describe Yugen as graceful profundity, but it's quite a mouthful. So, but it's about being profound. It's about being subtle, and it's about that revealing of the hidden. And although we talk about it now almost exclusively in a Noen Kyogen context, that's where Yugen is most frequently found as an aesthetic term, I fervently believe that that can be found in other cultures and in other styles. Mm-hmm. And so I am trying with my programming to find ways to make it so we can find that Yugen in other places. I was learning to speak Japanese in college because I never learned it growing up. Even though I am half Japanese, my family is Japanese. My grandparents, after the Second World War, refused to speak Japanese anymore. They stopped speaking it entirely. So my dad never learned it. None of my aunts or uncles know it. None of my cousins speak. And so I decided that I really wanted to be able to watch anime without subtitles. So I started taking Japanese classes, and my Japanese professor suggested that I start looking into classical Japanese theater to complement my theatrical studies. I discovered I had a real love for it and an academic interest in it, and so I applied to go to graduate school here in San Francisco at San Francisco State to study with Dr. Yuki Goto. So I moved here. My previous artistic director, Jubilith Moore, was an adjunct professor at the time at San Francisco State. She was doing a Noan Kyogen semester-long training course that I signed up for, and that's how I was introduced to Theater of Yugen, and that's how I really became an actual practitioner of the traditional arts.
How do you feel now being so entrenched in a traditional Japanese culture and tradition? Like, how you being half Japanese, mm-hmm. does it feel like it's always been a part of you? Do you feel like, oh, of course I've arrived here? Is it a surprise?
It's definitely not where I ever thought my life would go. That's for sure. It's so interesting, that question about what it's like to be half and to be working in a traditional art, because in America, I still feel very Asian. I'm white passing for the most part. And outside of California and Hawaii, which are the other two places I've studied, people don't really ping me as Asian anymore. They tend to ask me if I'm Latino. No, I'm not. But instead, I feel like I'm more Asian now that I'm connected to this traditional form. And in some ways, it does inform how I am in the world, like what I feel like I am able to be. But when I go back to Japan to study, I have never felt more American. I've never felt more white. And frequently when I go, because I'm mostly white passing, when I go and I meet people there, they don't treat me as Asian really in any way. I am simply the American who's here to study. And so when I do meet Japanese people in that context and like I introduce who I am and stuff, sometimes people actually ask me, no, what's your real name? Not the name you gave yourself in Japanese class. And so I'll pull out my passport to show them, like, no, my family name is Ishimaru, I'm half. Then they go, oh, no. And so studying these traditional forms, I'm always reminded that I'm an outsider. I am never going to be an insider in that world.
What does Yugen Theater do with these stories and these traditions?
So Yuriko, our founder, was trained originally in No, but she came to find a real love of Kyogen as she got older. And by older, I mean like into her late 20s and early 30s. So still, she started training in No when she was quite young. I believe she was still a child when she started training. And one of her aunts is a No performer. She's an amateur No performer, but has won national competitions for her singing. So she grew up sort of in this world. And Yuriko discovered in college and in graduate school her love of these more earthy human stories that Kyogen tells. So she specialized in performing Kyogen in San Francisco, and as her career developed, she started specializing in performing them in English. Kyogen relies very heavily on wordplay, and so there's lots of puns. Japanese is what we call a sound-poor, rhyme-rich language. Meaning there's not a lot of individual sounds, but because of that, there's a lot of punning and a lot of rhyming. It makes it real easy to do alliteration in multiple meanings with different words. But because of that linguistic complexity, it's very difficult to translate to English.
I bet, and to also add the aesthetic of the alliteration in
exactly.
there, too.
Exactly. Wow. And so we have spent most of the last four decades figuring out what parts do we just need to scrap because they're never going to work in English, or what do we change to make even though the translation might not be exactly precise anymore, it gives the same sense of the comedic timing we want and the alliteration and the vocal timing that we want. And that was the bedrock of our company.
The Theater of Yugen specifically, though, experiments a lot, right?
Yes.
With East and Western cultures and
absolutely.
Stories, old stories, new stories.
Yes.
So there is a trying to bridge together
absolutely.
Multiple strings and
yes, multiple heritages, multiple aesthetics. Even though I say that we were founded on the aesthetic of Noan Kyogen, this is not to say that our work has always exclusively been Japanese. When Yuriko first began her big experimental works, she actually started with Greeks, with the Greek plays, Trojan Women, Medea, Electra. These were the works that she started with, and she gave Noan Kyogen aesthetic to those works, but they were the Greek works. She presented the Greek plays. And even as she got into some of her later experimental works, she was doing things like a Kyogen version of Waiting for Godot, or Godot, mm-hmm. however you wish to pronounce it. And that was a big thing that she really liked to explore, was how does – How can we use some of these Japanese aesthetics to better reveal the intricacies of Western literature? And as Yuriko stepped down as artistic director and her later generations came on, they continued that hybridization and that interest in work. In the last couple of decades, we've gone very, very much more towards knowing Kyogen rooted work and creating original works that use like no aesthetic or were based in no dramatic structure or in Kyogen dramatic structure. You know, like we just talked about, I don't always feel that Japanese. And in some ways, because I feel so far on the outside, I can't in good conscience continue to say, well, I'm going to perform knowing Kyogen traditionally forever because I will always be an outsider. And I don't want to appropriate that own part of my history and bring that to the stage and say, look at these traditions that I'm trying to learn and look at how close I get to the authentic thing. Although I feel like I can do that with our Kyogen in English because I've trained in it with professionals for so long and I feel like I have a pretty good command of that, I don't feel comfortable saying like, look, I can replicate Kyogen. I want to find ways that those aesthetics speak to me and find ways to allow those to speak to other people. And that's actually the area that I'm more interested in as an artist and as a director and as an artistic director is where does that hybridity exist and how can we use hybridity to bring out deeper truths?
That was Theater of Yugen Artistic Director Nick Ishimaru speaking with KALW's True Quinn. You can catch Theater of Yugen's latest production, Helen, now at the No Space Theater in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. For today's, we sent KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs to San Francisco's Hayes Valley.
This is Gavotte en Rondo from Partita E Major by Johann Sebastian Bach. It's easily one of classical music's greatest hits, a standard. What's not so standard is where and how it's being performed. Violinist Nadia Tishman stands on a platform in the middle of an industrial-looking room, surrounded by people lounging on ottomans holding cocktails. While she plays, an image of the Voyager 1 space probe slowly drifts across three screens mounted above her head. It's an homage to the Golden Record launched back in 1977, featuring, among other things, this very piece. At tonight's performance, we'll travel musically, not only to space, but to Hawaii, pastoral England, Peru, and inside computer circuitry. This kind of musical exploration is normal at Soundbox. Soundbox is the San Francisco Symphony's experimental music space. First launched in 2014, each concert at Soundbox has a theme and is put together by curators. These concerts feel totally different than going to the symphony, and they're supposed to.
You know, there's sort of a considerable amount of baggage with the traditional symphony brand, and, you know, it becomes obvious that the disconnect of what people think of us versus what we are is really extreme.
Richard Lonsdorf is the Associate Director of Artistic Planning at the San Francisco Symphony and one of the people responsible for making Soundbox happen. It's usually a shared rehearsal space for both the symphony and the opera. But in the opera's off-season, December through April, the symphony didn't have much use for it, so they decided to use it as kind of a musical laboratory.
It didn't really have legs until we could figure out how to make it sound good in there because it's a terrible natural acoustic.
Enter the Meyer Constellation sound system, 28 microphones and 85 speakers that take in the sound of the room, modify it, and then send it back out again in an altered form. It's been called the Photoshop for sound.
So here we are in kind of one of the more resonant settings we have.
I'm standing in the soundbox room 9 hours before showtime with one of this show's curators, Edwin Outwater. He's showing me how the Meyer system works.
I'm going to clap 3 times. You'll hear the echo that's been created by the sound system. Now we'll turn it off, and you'll hear it without any sound. This is the natural acoustics of the room. Pretty amazing.
It's kind of like the difference between watching a movie with surround sound rather than hearing it through your laptop speaker. There are some pre-programmed settings, like cathedral, as well as specific tweaks you can make to the sound of the room for things like acoustic warmth or reverberation strength. But the Meyer system is only one of the many ways Outwater, as a curator, can and does play with the music in this space. There's also, for example, the visuals.
Imagine you're playing a piece by Vaughan Williams.
Ralph Vaughan Williams, an English composer writing at the turn of the 19th century. This piece features a singer performing a poem against an animated backdrop.
You see an English meadow, you know, around the singer.
In summer time on Breeden, the bells they sound so clear.
And the visual cue hits the emotional centers as well as the auditory without explaining what this poem is about, that it's about, you know, people want to get married and the fiance dies prematurely and she goes to the church alone in a coffin. You know, you may not catch that, but somehow it just enhances and people, they start to breathe into the music with these little things.
Music like this can be inaccessible to a younger audience. And for a more traditional symphony audience, modern pieces might be more challenging. Soundbox tries to breathe into the music by programming both, like this genre-bending piece from composer and co-curator of tonight's Soundbox, Mason Bates. Mason Bates is on stage at his laptop, accompanied by a small orchestra. They're performing The Rise of Exotic Computing. It's inspired by the notion that computers can generate their own ideas. Featuring a variety of musical genres allows each piece to shine in a new context. And it also allows musicians to have a moment in the limelight.
I mean, I think I've played almost all of them except for a couple that did not have any percussion or conflicted with major percussion works on stage.
Jake Nisley, the principal percussionist for the San Francisco Symphony, plays xylophone in this piece.
For percussion, especially, it gives us a vehicle to be more than just a color, more than just a part of the texture, but to actually sort of be the melody per se.
You know, a lot of what we're combating is the intimidation of a very dense and historic art form.
That's Richard Lonsdorf again.
Which is, you know, the field of orchestral music for the last, I don't know, 600-700 years. And that can be daunting if you're an uninitiated listener. And so this is really an approach at programming to say, welcome, come on in, you'll get everything you need to know when you arrive.
The Soundbox team is already thinking about next season's offerings, and curator Edwin Outwater would be happy to be back.
There's a sense of joy for me as a creative person in an empty space. There's no sense of tradition because it's a new tradition. I've learned that the audience has infinite capacity for intensity, humor, sadness, you know, deep emotional experiences, and in fact, they're desperately craving those. So the intention to dumb down is always the wrong intention.
And that's the elusive goal, challenging and inspiring audiences while making sure that the music stays accessible and engaging. And to make that work, they'll have to continue to think outside the box. For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
The next Soundbox shows take place this weekend. Want to stay up on cool events taking place all around the Bay Area? Subscribe to our newsletter, and we'll keep you informed with the sights and sounds and stories to make a difference. We're at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. The music we're hearing right now is by Luminance from San Francisco. They're performing at the Red Poppy Art House in the city this Saturday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Porfirio Rangel, and Lisa Wang. Our engineers are James Rollins and Tarek Foda. Content manager is Shireen Adel. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Our deputy news director is Angela Johnston. And our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.